Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Michaela Canterbury. Michaela is the author of the book, Sister Siren, a nonfiction about addiction. And in the book, she details the ups and downs of being the sister of an addict and shows the reader the journey it takes to love someone through addiction. She's also a lawyer and studied law at Gonzaga University and graduated from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. And so she has quite an extensive background in addition to her experiences, unfortunately, with addiction. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about how addiction affects people and how we can best support those people in our lives who are struggling with addiction. And without further ado, welcome to the show, Michaela. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, I am glad to have you here because this is something that a lot of people struggle with. And I feel like some of the listeners who are tuning into this podcast, they may have someone in their lives who is struggling with addiction. Could be alcohol, could be harder drugs, it could be any number of different things. But addiction is a very real thing that does happen in people's lives. And sometimes we don't know how to deal with that, what to do with the people who are in our lives. We love these people. We want to help them. We want to support them, but we just don't know really what the best things are to do or what not to do, I guess, in some cases. And so, you know, I'm kind of glad to have you on to talk about some of this stuff. So before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a trial lawyer from Eagle River, Alaska. I practice in Anchorage, Alaska, and I practice law with my husband, and our law firm was started by my father. And so, yeah, I'm a lawyer by trade and I'm educated that way. And I was raised in the same town. So I was raised in Eagle River, Alaska. And the background with how addiction came into our life is that, so my sister is 13 years my junior. So it's like my parents got a built-in babysitter, if you will. And I was like a really cool sub-parent. And there were like, we're connected, but we were also like two only children, you know? So she was an elite athlete. Like she was a speed skater. She represented our state at the Oregon Winter Games. She was a college athlete. So, you know, she was a high functioning person. And we are a family of high functioning professionals. My dad's a trial lawyer, like I mentioned. My mom has a PhD. My kids are, you know, good athletes and playing college athletics and such. And so this addiction thing was happening under the noses of our family, our community. I mean, the coaches didn't know, and employers and all that didn't know, because we were so high functioning and she was high functioning. She was performing very well, you know, A's and B's and, you know, and, you know, making great teams. And so this was happening and we didn't know. So that's kind of the background of me. And so when it came into my life, I didn't know. And I didn't know what to do, because I'm just going and being a trial lawyer, raising my kids, being a hockey mom, you know, all that jazz. And so I didn't know about, my sister's addiction was heroin and meth. And it started with pills when she broke her ankle at the Arctic Winter Games in Canada. And they prescribed her, they gave her hydrocodone and oxycodone. And that started like when she was 13-ish. So preteen time. And then she, you know, overcame that injury. And that was a significant injury, an ankle break. I'm a personal injury lawyer, so that's my deal. I know slip and falls, ankle breaks, they're serious injuries. Anyway, shortly after that, she was assessed with ADHD and given the medication for that diagnosis. And this is like late 80s, early 90s, when the medical community didn't know a lot about the addictive qualities of those medications and didn't know this ADHD assessment at that time was, people were, I'll just be real, they were just making fun of it. Like, oh, I should have ADHD because of blah, 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 whatever, you know? But that was happening, and she was on these medications at a young age. And then her, and this is my theory, I'm no medical doctor, I just play one on TV like I tell people, but her body, mind, and spirit became dependent on, and I mean, it's just part of her being as being dependent upon medications. And it progressed from there throughout high school, into college, into post-college and life. And it went down a slippery slope in her mid-30s is when she slipped down and began IV drug use.
Yeah, and that's such a terrible thing too, because obviously none of the doctors who prescribed those medications earlier on in her life were thinking that any of this negative effect would have happened, right? They, you know, obviously there was some pain, right? You break your ankle, there's some pain involved, and you're going to need something to help manage that pain. But knowing what they know now, and, you know, I know hindsight is 2020, and, you know, mm-hmm. you can look back, but knowing what they know now, I'm sure the doctors would not have wanted to get her into that situation, because that's life altering, you know, that could have had terrible consequences down the road. And for a short term, you know, the ankle healed in a relatively short period of time, in contrast to the lifespan of an individual, right? You know, 100%. You can deal with something that is a little bit less potent as far as the painkiller goes, to be able to manage that pain, but not necessarily make the person become dependent on whatever it is. You know, something like Advil or something like that would be a little bit easier to manage and not become addicted to it, as opposed to some of these other medications that she was prescribed, right? So,
yes, Scott, you're exactly correct. I mean, and 100%. My parents were, I mean, she's like a preteen going into her teen years. And so they're doing what the doctors are telling them to do. You know, my dad was a personal injury attorney too. And we worked with doctors, and we worked with people who were in pain. And so there was so much guilt around this when it was reaching fever and she's homeless and on the streets. And I mean, each of us, each member of our family was this heavy thing on our chest about, is this our fault? Did we contribute to this? You know, and we battled that our own self as to what our contribution was. And so, and that's how, you know, noodling through how each person in a family can support and love this person in their life that's struggling with this while you're struggling with your own. What did I do to contribute to this? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, it also takes you off guard when you're in a family that is high functioning, like you were saying, like advanced degrees, excelling at athletics and everything else. You have people who seemingly, like, this can't happen to these people, because how are you performing at this high level with all the stuff that the drugs are doing to your mind and your body and everything? How are you still able to perform at that level?
Exactly.
So how would you think that would be something that would actually happen to someone in your family? Now, obviously, if the person was functioning at this high level, performing elite athletic performances and doing great, and then all of a sudden did a 180 and couldn't even qualify for some of these things, then you might say, okay, well, there's something up here. But when you continue to excel academically, athletically, professionally, whatever the case may be, it's not easy to really spot what the problem might be, because exactly. It seems like everything's going
it's
well,
so
right?
It's so sneaky. It just, you know, it's like a little eel. Into your life and starts eating and gets bigger and bigger. And then these things start happening, you know, and there's car crashes, there's losing jobs, there's having these injuries, and there's destabilizations in marriage relationships or family relationships. And I mean, my parents, like I said, we all have advanced degrees. And in my business as a trial lawyer, I'm always learning and studying like what my client's injury is and how it gets fixed and those kinds of things and what the options are. And so, and it just didn't even cross my radar. But we would talk about, gee, does she have a disability? does she have a mental health component here? Like my mom was head of her department at University of Alaska in the human services department. And so she's a mental health counselor and a PhD, you know? And so we were thinking maybe my sister needs to be on disability because of the ADHD and the panic attacks. And so we were trying to plug in these presentations that we thought were evolving and didn't put our finger on that this was the consequences of addiction, you know, like amping it up. And of course she wasn't telling us that she was using drugs, but we knew that she was, you know, that ADHD was managed a certain way and physical injuries, wear and tear injuries, you know, from the car wrecks that she was involved in were managed a certain way, but just weren't able to put our finger on it. And I had a lot of guilt over that too, because I was like, I was representing her in the car wrecks, you know, I mean, the car wrecks were her fault. I mean, I'm just like, so like, yeah, I touched on that a little bit earlier about, gee, what's our contribution to each of the, to this? And so, yeah, I kind of dealt with that. And so that's kind of what I'm so grateful that you invited me on the show, because I can look at these things in hindsight and say, aha, and then this is what worked for me to support her when things were getting real, you know?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I know there's probably some listeners out there who are dealing with someone who is in their lives, there's a loved one, a family member, someone in their lives that is struggling with an addiction. So what are some of the ways that we can support them in through the process that they're going through?
Yeah, I first recommend getting real with your own self about what you can do. People talk a lot about this as like setting boundaries. And I'm kind of reframing that because it sounds so mean to me. Actually, it's my boundary. So I reframe it to, you know, what are people's, where's your skill set? And what are the limits? What are your limits? This is as much as I can do. I love you. And this is as much as I can do. You got to love yourself first to figure that out. All right. So self-care and really noodling on how you can show up with the addict that you love that's in your life. And we all have different limits, and you can't be getting mad at other people's limits. All right. So I can't be getting mad that my husband can only do so much. Just like I knew analytically, my kids, they were teenagers at the time. They will only do so much, you know? Right. And then as they evolve, I mean, their relationship with their auntie, now that they're adults, you know, I'm not going to control that. I'm in control of my relationship with the addict that I love. Okay. And where are my limits on that? Okay. And it might not be the same every day or every month or whatever, but anywho, getting real with that as to what you can do to, and not, I'm an overgiver just by nature. So, and not where it's taking away from you and dehydrating your own, you know, life energy. I mean, I got to that point. And so that's why I really encourage people, self-care, noodle with yourself, how you can love. That's number one. Okay. How you can step in with this person that you love. And so these were the things that I did. I wanted to, yeah, I could be her emergency contact. I could step in that way. I could be her power of attorney. And I could get releases of information, and I could support her that way. I have that capability. My day job's a lawyer. I got the papers. I can do this. I know how to talk with doctors, you know, so I had that capability. So I could step in that way, you know, so like my husband couldn't or other people couldn't. So whatever people's skill sets are, that's how you step in. I love to cook. I love to bake. So I would bring meals. So anything made with love is good for you, right? So I would make healthy meals and I would bring them. If I knew that there were things that she needed, Narcan, a first aid kit, water, a phone charger, things that weren't taking away from me, but I could do and I could show up with love. She also liked to journal and she would revert to color. And so I would bring, it was a form of therapy for her. She desperately wanted recovery, but relapse is real. And this is hard. These slippery heels are hard. And so doing what I can do to support her in her recovery, that's knowing also, third, read up a bit and inform yourself on what your loved one's addiction is. So you can forecast perhaps what their triggers are. and what their needs are. So love yourself, show up in love with how you can, how you show up in love, and inform yourself about their addiction. And you know, do what you can do, what skill sets and tools that you bring.
Right. And I think that's important too, because if you are trying to stretch yourself too thin, you're going to end up burning yourself out and getting to the point where perhaps you just give up on the person. And that's not helpful for anybody in that situation. That's not really going to solve the problem. It's not going to make, it's not going to help them get any better. It's not going to make you feel better about what you're doing, because you know at some point giving up is giving up, and that's a crappy place to be in any sort of relationship. You don't want to be doing that, especially not in a sibling relationship like yours, or any close family member. You don't want to just give up on them no matter how bad things get. But you do have to take care of yourself first. And I use this example all the time. When you get on an airplane, they tell you to put the oxygen mask on yourself first if there's a loss of cabin pressure, and then help others who might be around you. So if you're traveling with your kids, it may be a paternal instinct to go and help your kids first. But if they're struggling because they're scared and they're resisting putting the mask on, well, both of you are going to end up passing out before anyone gets a mask on. So, take care of yourself first, then you're going to be able to take care of the other person. And I think the same kind of idea applies here, because if you're not able to take care of yourself, then the other person is going to be just be draining you down, and you're going to have nothing left to give. And so you have to be able to take care of yourself. Go for walks, or exercise. Get yourself, a good night's sleep. Get a good meal. Take care of yourself. Do the things that you need to do for you. And then you'll be able to come and support the person in a loving way and be able to give more than you would otherwise. Right?
100%. You are exactly correct, Scott. I mean, that's part of when you don't take care of yourself, your ability to step into those moments that you are called to. You are called to these moments. They are before you for a reason. But to step, everything feels so desperate and emergent, like when the plane's going down, this is desperate, this is emergent, But particularly when my sister was on the streets and in trapped out places, I was like, the phone would ring, I would be traumatized, everything. It was like, I almost felt guilty taking care of myself, because if I did, I wouldn't be there for her when the call came. And so I started developing little routines to trigger in my head, positive routines to trigger in my head, how to care for myself so I could step into those moments. And so I have what I call MWBT, morning well-being time. And I now wake up early to have my MWBT, and I get kind of snarky at people if they're getting up early too, including my dogs. I'm like, hey, you're interrupting my MWBT, and that's a practice that I developed for my own self, and everybody might have a different one. I make myself a beautiful cup of tea. I light a candle and I contemplate and discern head on what is what I call an RFF, a red flag feeling. When my sister was in active addiction, it was fear. It was resentment. And those were hurdles for me to connect with her. And so I needed to meet those RFFs head on so I could do what I needed to do. And doing that is so friggin' healthy. So, but I could get lost in thought too. So I'd have to set a timer. But then, yes, I'd go on a walk in nature. I had this routine with my dogs, and it just like filled me so I could step in and I would know this is fear and this is how I'm dealing with her, or this is resentment and this is how I'm dealing with her, And then in the evening, a wind down practice, which for me, that was just a beautiful tub, with some Epsom salts and this and that. But I'd also, what were the blessings of the day, even though it may have been a rough day. And I have this thing, it's called the rose rule. Because there's more petals on a rose than there are thorns, and our brain tends to go to the thorns. And so, this went wrong, or I didn't, blah, 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 And so I'd let my brain think that, because it's going to think that. But then I'd say, for every thorn, there's three petals. So I'd have to have three blessings, three goodness, three wins, three that, and then I can pull the shade, on the day, and, you know, put the cell phone around the corner. So that's not, so I'm not wigging out about, you know, who's calling, but those kinds of things. So I developed practices for my own self to navigate through the day and then sleep well at the night. So then when I wake up the next day, I can close the day and then wake up with a new day.
And again, these practices are going to be different for everybody, but I think it's important for everyone to be conscious of this, that they need to take care of themselves and figure out how best to take care of their own needs before jumping in and helping anyone else. And I think this is true regardless of whether or not you have someone in your life who is struggling with addiction or needs, you know, special medical care. You know, they may have some illness or disability or whatever that you are the caregiver for, and you need to provide help for them. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life. I think it's important to kind of take care of your own needs first, so that way when even unexpected things come up, you know, someone is in a car accident and they're in the hospital. Now there's something that I need to go and care for this person. This is unexpected. I wasn't planning on this, but I'm already stretched too thin because I've overcommitted myself. I've done all these things. Now I have nothing left to give to this person who needs me. And, you know, this is a person, a loved one in your life. You want to be there for them. But when you're stretched too thin, you're going to find yourself resenting the person. Oh, I can't believe that they got into this car accident. Oh man, God, if they were just a little more careful, you know, then I wouldn't have to do this for them. And, you know, and that's not the best place to be mentally either. So, you know, practicing some of these things, I think, is a good thing. It's just good all around in general practice, but it's really important when you're dealing with something, like a loved one who's going through an addiction, because a lot of times you end up putting yourself on the back burner so that you can give more to that person. But if you don't have anything left to give, it's going to be hard. So,
right. Well, so you can fix them. So you can rescue them. Right. So you can get them to rehab. So you can, I mean, that's what I started learning. I was wanting her recovery more than she wanted it. I was giving too much that way. I'm driving through snowstorms to get her, you know, to trap houses to pick her up and take her to a doctor's appointment. I wanted it more than she did. And when that, I was just like, whoa. This is, you know, I'm giving too much. I'm doing too much, you know, retract. Sure. And that was another thing is like, what do they call it? They call it detaching with love. I reframed that one too, because I couldn't stop loving her, Scott. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't like just turn that, like, I'm going to turn off the hot water. It's too much here. No, I can't do that. I can modulate this best I can, but learning to love her from afar. And that would wax and wane and ebb and flow depending upon, you know, what I was doing in my life. I wanted to be able to still show up for my children and in my marriage and for my parents and in my law practice and for my clients. But I wanted to show up for her, but there's only so much I can do. So these other things aren't shutting down, you know, in my life.
Now, we talked about some of the things that we should do for the people who are struggling in our lives, who might be dealing with addictions. What are some things that we should not do? I think that maybe is equally as important, what to do and what not to do, because sometimes we may walk into something well-intentioned, but if we are doing the wrong thing, no matter how good we might feel about it, if we're doing the wrong thing, it's going to end up causing a bigger problem than it's worth. So what are the things that we should not do when we're trying to support an addict in our lives?
Yeah. And this is just, again, based on my experience and my feelings. My book, I also call it a field guide on how to love an addict. So this works for people who love addicts as well, because it's a very lonely place. It can be. Loving an addict feels alone. And for sure, people in active addiction feel alone. Number one, don't tell them what to do. Nobody likes to be told what to do. And I remember, I mean, I was loving her so much and missing her so much. And somebody else I know that I love so much was like, you know what you need to do with your sister? I'm like, what? My relationship with my sister is my deal. Your relationship with her is your deal. Just, you know, so don't tell them what to do. Rather, on the flip, hold space how you can. know that about yourself. So don't tell them what to do. Just hold space or be there and show up in love. With my sister in particular, and she was, like I said, hard drugs, don't give them cash. It's going to go right to right to the drugs. That includes gift cards, things that can be easily be sold. And don't be signing contracts that connect you, whether it's a rental contract or a new car. Those are what people call enabling type behaviors. And so, and then it gets you on the line as well. And our family struggled with that, especially my mom. And I had to navigate what I could do because remember, my day job is a lawyer. So I always got the calls when she was in jail. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I can't give you free legal stuff. This can't happen. So like paying bills and things like that. I mean, when I had talked about the guilt, there was a lot of, man, did we prolong this? Because we were doing things for her, basically, no accountability for the legal issues that she was getting involved in, because we would come in and fix it, or do it, or, navigate her through the process in a way that benefited her. And there was no accountability, if you will. And so I had often thought, gee, and I felt bad about it and, prayed about it. Did I prolong it? And so anyway, but that's also like the MWBT and the RFFs that people experience. What is enabling for you is again a personal thing. It's got to noodle that your own self so you're at peace with it. So that's the best advice I have to give.
Yeah,
not to do with an addict.
Yeah, I think that those are great pieces of advice, and especially some of the things that you mentioned. I didn't even occur to me that this would be an issue, but even you're right. Things like, co-signing on a loan or like a car loan or a, rental agreement or things like that, then you're on the hook for the payments of those things if they don't come through. And I think a lot of people understand that when you have someone who's an addict, a lot of times they blow a lot of the money that they come through or come across on the drugs that they are using to maintain that addiction. And then they don't have the money for the rent or the car payments or whatever else they might need. And so now you're basically looking like, if you have your own rent for your own place and now you have somebody else's, now you're basically doubling the rent. And
right.
That's and probably the damage more than did. A lot. Right. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
In there.
That's true too. Yeah, that's true, because now they have that money freed up and they're able to now go and do even more damage with that money. So yeah, those are great pieces of advice. The things to do, things not to do.
Like damage to the rental unit you'll be on the hook for that too. And then if it became a trapped out place and there's damage and there's broken windows and stuff like that, and then they become homeless. I only know this from experience. It wasn't me, but I saw this unfold. And then if you sign this, then you're on there and you can get sued, not only for the back rent, but for the damage done. And then there's the legal fees. And in Alaska, we have what's called the loser pays. And so you got to pay the other side's attorney's fees and your own, So it's just really the consequences of that, of is putting your name on something. And you think that you're helping, you're getting them a place to live so they're not on the streets. But, you become accountable for everything. I mean, like financially and legally accountable for that down the road.
Right. And that's not a place that anyone wants to be in, because then that just leads to more problems. And again, we're talking about things like resentment and stuff like that, where when you're dealing with those situations, like, I was trying to help, I was trying to do all these good things, and then they just threw it in my face. And they did, like, that's not the type of relationship that you want to have. So, really, I think it is a matter of just taking some time and thinking through what it is that you're doing and providing for these people. Like things like providing a meal, like you said, you could cook a meal for your sister and provide that to her. That's a nice thing. You can provide that. She has warm meal in her stomach for that night. And that's something that you could feel good about. It'll help her out. That's a good thing, but you're not long-term, you're not on the hook for damage done to an apartment or something like that. Right. So,
right. Or be sued for it. Right.
Exactly.
Right. Just thinking about the long-term, I mean, because it's good intentions. It's exactly what my mom did. My mom like signed there and, you know, and then she's on the hook. But being, and that gets back to what we started with, is how can I step in? What are my limits? I can't give you I mean, I think the long term, okay, this could potentially be $8,000 to $10,000. You know, sorry, I've got a family. My husband and I, we talk about our, you know, our finances. So we're not going to be, you know, that's not fair to him. You know, that's not fair to that relationship, you know, to overcommit this way. And so but you can speak that truth to the addict you love, you know, and that's exactly what I did. You know, honey, I got kids that are going to be going to college. I can't do that. Doesn't mean I don't love you. I love you. But what can I do?
You know? Exactly. And when you have that moment, when you realize what it is that you can do and you set those limits, those boundaries, you don't cross over those boundaries. And then it allows you to do the things that you can do. And those things will help you move closer to the goal line, as opposed to taking you further away or taking you out of the game entirely. If you get to that point where you're like, I just can't do this anymore, you know?
Right. And there's truthful respect there without the characterization that you don't love me or that love is conditional. You know, right. I mean, when it's said with love, like, this is all I can do. It's the truth. I love you. This is it, you know?
Exactly. And when you do all that you can do, I mean, there's really nothing else that people can ask for realistically. And so that's a good way to think about it. I think when you have these situations, you know, come down and sit, you know, if you're married, sit down with your spouse and say, okay, this is a situation. I want to help as much as I can. What are our limits? And let's figure that out. So that way I don't accidentally cross over the line and commit to something that we can't realistically support, you know.
Such an excellent point, Scott. I mean, that was one of the things that we were talking about, is like how to support the addict you love during the holidays and such, and this time of year, and like going into January when you have the Blue Monday and the like saddest day of the year, whatever. But when you're gathering with your family, it's just like, how are we going to, what are our limits here, right? How are we going to gather when we know that there's an addict and we love them? How are we going to support them? Like, we just had Thanksgiving, and my sister and her boyfriend were able to join us, and we're celebrating 4 years of recovery this March, which is awesome. But we were, you know, there was alcohol there, and but having options for, you know, the people that are in recovery and what's going to be triggering them, then what their backup plan, and are you their exit buddy, or, you know, if this, then that, how can I support you in this, which it may be a triggering moment, you know, and if Uncle Bob is like kind of antagonistic or, you know, whatever, don't be the foil to Uncle Bob or whatever. So, but also talking with your family members and the people that you're gathering with is, you know, how are we going to gather for the holidays, or how are we going to do this? And it doesn't have to, we can also have sober events and we can do things, you know, in Alaska, we're getting more snow, but we can sled and we can ski and we can skate and we can have cocoa and we can do other, we can walk in nature, you know, and we can play games or whatever, but just like talking with each family member about how they can show up and their comfort level in that.
Right. And I think it's important to understand that each situation, each person is going to be different, and they may change along the way in their recovery journey too, where maybe early on in recovery, they may not be able to go to an event where there's going to be alcohol or other things like that, where they are going to be tempted to partake in that. Later on in their journey, maybe they'll be more able to, they'll build up some of that resilience and they'll be able to go to these events where there is alcohol around, and they'll just be okay with other people partaking in it and not do it themselves. And so really, like you said, you got to have that conversation with people and make sure that you understand what they're able to handle and have those alternatives. You know, don't have a whole bar of, you know, beer and wine and spirits and everything else out and have no other alternative beverage, you know, offered.
Right.
That would be pretty in your face, kind of a rough thing to do. Right. So, you know, just provide those options.
If you see that's happening, then go get them some water, you know, or go, you know what I mean? Like just being aware and observant. I mean, like if you're hosting, have an alternative, but if you're someplace else and you see that they're there, what are they going to have to drink? You know, like, go do it, you know? So they're just not sitting there awkwardly being on their phone, being thirsty, going, oh.
Yeah, exactly. But you mentioned something else, which I wanted to highlight here too, that there is hope for those who are struggling with addiction. Your sister's coming up on 4 years of recovery here and not using the drugs that she was using before. What was that recovery journey like for your sister and you and your family as she was going through all of this?
Yeah, it was, she was in active addiction for 3-ish years. I mean, like homeless, all that kind of stuff. And her story of recovery, there were relapses and went to rehab and those kinds of those, you know, went twice in and out of rehab. And that's, you know, we've talked about this. We talk in tandem together too. And her story of recovery is that there were some major things that fell down. And, you know, they call it hitting your rock bottom. Man, did I hate that word. I hate that term. Because I was trying too hard, harder than her to get her into recovery. And they're like, well, did she reach rock bottom? I'm like, are you asking me if she's dead yet? No, she's not. Can you help me? You know, and I would get so mad at these people. And I didn't know. And I pray about it. I ask for forgiveness because I was kind of snarky, but the road to recovery, you know, there were bumps and there were, you know, you take 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, and then there's some lateral moves. And there was just a compilation of events that happened as she tells her story to recovery. But my story to recovery in loving her is learning to love her from afar at those moments where it was hurting too much for me. And I never stopped loving her, but there were times I needed to really have some distance and put my limits out there. And we have an understanding about it. And now, let me back up just a little bit. She called me. I mean, like she called me and she told me that some stuff had happened and can I get her? And I'm like, yes, I can. She can't stay with me. I can get you to someplace, but this is all I can do. Our family also did an intervention. She never denied that she was addicted and that there were issues there. It was almost like, thanks, but no thanks to that bridge to nowhere. You know, I'm going to do it my way. My family thought that was, you know, that the intervention was a failure. I never thought that because we all spoke our truth and she spoke hers. And so we were all on the same page and she knew we loved her and we just can't be on this crazy train with her anymore. And so the door was always open for her when she wanted our help to go into rehab. And so when she reached out for that, we were able to step in and do that. And it wasn't, you know, like I said, it was, you know, rehab and then rehab again and things like that. So, but yeah, she found what worked for her. There were some, you know, this is just an outsider view and being someone who loves her is, and she's a mental health therapist too. So when she's going into, and she worked in substance abuse counseling. So when she would go into rehab, she knew exactly what was going on. And I almost think like it threatened she was like a threat, like they were afraid of her because she's like, you can't do that. Yeah, that's a violation of HIPAA, you know? And if you didn't, when she didn't fall in line, I'll put it that way, fall in line with the rubric of the rehab facility she's in, because she's like calling them on what she thought were not appropriate ways to do things, then that's not stepping in line. And so, boom. You know, and she's like, no, this is a team sport. Are you on my team or is this punitive? So she had kind of her winding road on that, you know, and she eventually found her way with, finding recovery. And then she was also able to get her husband into rehab, which was great. And that was after they were divorced. So that was, but it was a rough journey. No, I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it or, you know, there were heartbreak and everything, but she did the work.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I think the key here is that there is hope for people who in addiction and they do need to put in the effort. And, you know, I don't know that anybody really wants to, like, no one wakes up one morning and sets out and is like, you know what? I'm going to get addicted to something. You know,
when I grow up, like, I want to be an addict. No one ever said that.
I want to live on the streets. I want to, you know, be an addict. I want to, you know, whatever. Nobody really does that. And that, I think at the end of the day, it's hard to get off of that addiction train, but it's worth it in the end, you know, so you have to put in the work. I think anything worth doing is not going to be necessarily easy, but it's necessary to do at times, to do those hard things in order to achieve whatever the goal is. And in this case, recovering from that addiction, right?
Another thing that she mentions, and see, like, her story of recovery is different than mine, but I've heard it. And she knew a life with stability, stable family, being a professional, you know, having a car, things like she knew that life, and she knew that she could have that life. So that was never lost on her. And I was always able to see her light. Like, I've known her whole life. Whenever I saw her, I always saw my sister, and I always saw her light. Now, it got really small, but I still saw it. And so there is hope. There is healing. Even though there's 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, there's hope, there's healing. You're making progress. And those little successes, when they start building on each other, become big things, and their light becomes bigger. And the light that you have with each other becomes bigger. Now she's able to step in. I mean, like I mentioned, our parents are older and they have some medical conditions, and she and I are able to step in together to care for our parents. And when my dad had his stroke, she's like, my mom has Alzheimer's, so we had to care for my mom while my dad was in ICU. We show up at my parents' house and my mom's very confused. And my sister's like, I'm so glad I'm clean, that I can step in and be here and be present, even though this is shitty. I can be here and show up with the family.
And that's part of what
I get what I pray for. I prayed for that.
Yeah, and that's part of what I was trying to say before too, is if you're not taking care of yourself, then how are you going to be able to be there for other people when they need you? And in this case, your parents, they need you guys to be there for them. But, you know, they're in that time of their life where they need that support. And, you know, if your sister was still actively addicted to something, whatever it happens to be, she wouldn't be able to show up as well, or even at all in this case. And then everything would land on your plate. In addition to trying to figure out how to help your parents, now you're also going to have to figure out how to help your sister. And now you're stretched even more thin, and you're not going to be 100% there for anybody. So it's important to just really, at the end of the day, take care of ourselves. And that can help so many different ways. You know, it's an important thing to do. So I'm glad that you came on and talked about that. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, also being respectful, like, in that road to recovery that we were both on, she on hers, mine on, you know, I know her limits and she knows mine. And we can honestly communicate that to each other and not get mad at each other. You never share well. You never, you know, no, that is so unnecessary and doesn't help. And she's like, sis, I got to work, or I got to do this. This is what I can do. That laid track for us to be able to step in effectively with our parents.
Right. Yeah. And communication, I think, in any situation is always going to help things out, no matter what it is. I can't think of a situation where communicating what you're able to do, how you're able to do it, all that kind of stuff, I can't think of a situation that would hurt. You know, just come together, be open and honest. Don't be critical. Don't be judgmental of the other person. Yeah. And, you know, yeah, you may be able to give X amount, and they may be able to give less than that, but don't be critical. It's like, oh, I'm doing more than you, so I'm better, you know, anything. Like, that's just not helpful, because then they're going to start backing away and not wanting to help at all. And that doesn't help the end goal of whatever it is that you're trying to do. So yeah, definitely. I like that advice as well. Before we wrap up, tell us about your book, Sister Siren, and, you know, why you wrote it. Obviously we talked a lot about the situation here, but tell the listeners what it has to offer them when they read that book.
Sure. So Sister Siren, a nonfiction about addiction and a field guide on how to love an addict. It's just that it's the 3-year journey of our family. It's written memoir style. In the back, I have a glossary of terms. I realized DOC is drug of choice and not Department of Corrections. So I have a whole glossary of terms that I learned because remember, I didn't know any of this. And then we also, I have also the intervention letters that we wrote to my sister. I have letters that I wrote my sister. I have my MWBT practices in there and some kind of prompts for people to do their own. And then their evening practices. And I have I wrote the book, Scott, that I felt I needed when it was happening, because I was looking everywhere and I could find nothing. And so I wrote what I needed and I want to share it with everybody. So all the tools, what worked here, there is hope and healing and recovery. And this is what helped me. And I hope it helps others on their road to recovery.
Excellent. And that's a key thing. You know, you wrote the book that you wish was available when you were going through this. And I'm hoping that other people who are going through this get a copy of the book. It's has a lot of the answers to questions that you're probably asking yourself and trying to figure out what the best thing to do, what the best thing not to do, you know, how to just navigate this whole time in your life. So again, Sister Siren, a nonfiction about addiction. I will have the link to the book in the show notes. So anyone who's looking to get a copy, please check out the show notes. You can find the link there. Michaela, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I'm glad that we had this opportunity to chat, and I'm glad to hear that your family is, you know, getting back to some sense of normalcy after all of this. So thank you again for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.